Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Today, I thought we'd talk about something that I think a lot of you have intimate knowledge about and intimate opinions, intimate research about. Before I start, let me put a little disclaimer in here. This is just my opinion. These La Plumas are really good little sticks. Okay, so your humble narrator got into the video game business professionally in 1989, drawing old tile-based, the first 256 color games out there, which I must sound absurdly ancient, but I was very young and managed to manifest a bunch of talent. Before I got professionally involved in high school, I was known, even as a kid, for creating games. I drew my first video game in binary, as some of you have already heard. Sorry, I just want to preface this because people are going to try to, you know, they just need to know, right? About 11. My uncle was the programmer. I was the illustrator. He taught me how to do it. And so I took my drawings and I converted into binary blocks. Then he'd stack them up and color them. And he could multi-stack them if you wanted to do a bunch of different colors. And then I was hooked. I saw the movie Tron right shortly after that. And then I started programming on a bunch of different computers. A Commodore 64 for a little while until I realized that computer was screwed. Then a TRS-80 Coco computer. I'm like 12, 13, 14 years old. Finally got into high school, started going to the college, started getting access to Apple IIs. First access I had to one of those was in junior high. But I had a whiz kid friend of mine named Keith, and he was much older than me, maybe like 5 or 6 years older than me. He was giving me editors so I could take my artwork and turn them into sprites. And then I studied how to create sound waves, and I ended up creating, before I came out of high school, I mean, I created a bunch of like Zork type games where you would type in and get you'd have to escape a haunted house. That was one of my favorite themes. And then I did a multiplayer drag race game, Top Fuel drag race. So one player is on top, one player is on bottom. And I did this little spitting sound wave that I sped up. And so it really sounded like the popping sounds of a Top Fuel dragster. I put little random algorithms in there, which is kind of funny because I didn't really have much knowledge about it. You know, I just loved what they look like. And so, the, you know, two of you would have two sides of the keyboard pounding on it. And so the other thing was, is I had a, I was just obsessed with drawing digitally, and I was always black and white. And so once you master black and white, color, digitally anyway, is a much better second act than a first act, because you start to learn, you know, the geometry of pixels and all that stuff. So, and I was drawing fonts professionally and just always digital icons and, you know, clip art for programs that needed, you know, clip art for logos and things like that. Hundreds of logos. So by the time I got laid off from the TurboTax folks, I got a little job working for a company that, so what you have to understand about Activision is they're only a distributor. So they distribute what other companies do. It's a brilliant model. Our company was called Atomic Entertainment, then renamed it Aftershock Entertainment. I drew for at least two video games for them, but just a ton of things, like the Realm package, which is the world. When you look down on it, I did the sprite packages. I mean, I had to do like Greek gods. So imagine Medusa out of the old Clash of the Titans from the 80s with like a swimming snake hair, and, you know, it was eight different directions, and so it was the walking routines and then shooting things, and it's all by hand. There's no 3D modeling. You have to be an artist. You have to know how to animate. I got really lucky when I was 11 years old, I think it was. I got put into the Brockton Art Museum's animation workshop course. So it was like a little college course for anybody of any age, and you drew it all by hand, cell art and stuff like that. So I did an animation of Peace from the movie Wizards by Ralph Bakshi riding on the back of that animal he rode. And then I ended up doing, as a side project, I did a UFO flying down and zapping a radar on top of a building. I was 11 years old, whatever. By 93, I started contracting in Electronic Arts in all different ways. On the side, we were trying to create our first MMO with two of my other genius friends, and we had it all figured out. And then internally, EA had purchased Origin. Origin was creating Ultima Online. So by 1994, we're playing the essentially like the Delta versions of the game. And we're like, okay, we don't need to do this. We just need to make sure this game is great. And so for 4 years, play tested the hell out of that thing. It releases in 98. Meanwhile, I'm working on the physics of Andretti Racing as a tester, giving my feedback. As when I first came to California, I raced cars, little carts, you know, with a K. And eventually, worked on Knockout Kings. I did the music for some of the music for Knockout Kings. But when you're at EA, you do everything. You know, there's the technical roles you can have would be, I guess, tech support, which I never worked in, QA, which I started in. And then you have essentially associate producer, 3, 2, 1. Then you have producer. 3 is, I'm trying to think, I guess 3 was the highest. You know, sometimes it's the DEF CON, they reverse the numbers. But meanwhile, we're playing every video game out there. We're playing all the Westwood games, which we eventually acquired Westwood after we realized we couldn't beat them. It's really funny. So lots of Command & Conquer, Red Alert, the original versions of the game, tons of Duke Nukem, tons of Doom. So I've been around, and we would also do a lot of coin-op games. So we go out and play a lot of coin-op games at the golf and stuff and pizza parlors and all that stuff. EA even tried to get into coin-op at one point. When Virtual Fighter came out in the coin-op, we made a whole division of coin-op and tried to do it and bailed out of it. By 1999, I had developed so much internet talent that I took over the internet group of coders and then ended up taking over the whole department over 6 months or so and really exited studio. And most of my friends who were in studio, which is where what we call making game area, they migrated out and went to work for Microsoft, created their own video game companies. And so then by 2004, what I ended up doing was starting to make games online in Flash, which Flash had a tremendous amount of bugs, and so you had to be an extremely good coder. Eventually, because of my art background and artists that had failed us, I ended up having to cover for art as well as the code. Then I kind of got a chance to get out of the code, and I was always in the design part of it, so creating story behind whatever the hell was going on, you know. I gave Solitaire a story, okay, which I'll explain a little bit. I have taught at, I've lectured at, you know, Berkeley University, UC Irvine, Chapman University, Noman School of Art and Video, and was it Film and Television? They have a gaming division as well. So I've been around their industry for a very, very long time. I'm just an inquisitive person. So for me, you know, if someone would go off and create a pipeline diagram that was 40 feet long, which is how we made games at EA, I'd study the crap out of it, even though I didn't have to. At all times at EA, if you know the producers, which I knew quite a few of them, you get invited into the design meetings. And so you sit there and help design a James Bond game or some Rich Hillman masterpiece of his own creation. So you get to participate, you know, and not all your ideas are taken, but because I was always an engineer and an artist and a designer and a writer, when I suggested an idea, I saw the code, I saw the art, I saw all the bits and pieces that would need to be realized to make the feature come true. I studied game engines like crazy. I mean, you know, the game editors and how difficult it was to make a game, and it's always been fairly difficult. Up until recently. So, this episode is not about my background, but I wanted to give you that very quickly so that you kind of understand the value of perhaps the value of my opinion about what I'm about to say, because I think the gaming industry is clearly, financially, provably in really bad shape. And I don't think it's necessarily the fault of any game company. We have game companies that have made mistakes with their franchises. Unfortunately, that's a pretty organic process, and it's something that usually occurs. And that's why when you make a game company and the game company is successful, when you realize you have a successful team, you have to spend as much money as possible to keep that team happy and to make sure they never leave, to make sure they're inspired, find out what inspires them. It's not going to be something you give them necessarily. Most of the time, it's something they do in their personal life. You have to fuel it. If you had to give them gobs of money that you wouldn't normally give in any other business, that's what you have to do. And I'll give you a case in point. If any of you have seen the latest Marvel movies, right? I'm just going to mention Marvel, Infinity Wars Endgame. We won't talk about the movie at all. But realize how many people are cast in that film. It is everybody who's ever been in that film. Gwyneth Paltrow came back to be in that film. There are people, if you watch the credits at the end, who aren't even in the movie, like Natalie Portman, who get a full face credit. They're paying millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars to keep that franchise in place, to make sure that Robert Downey Jr. doesn't run off and create some other movie. And they'll try to contractually force him to stay in that. And every time he gives up some other opportunity, he's going to say that'll cost you $10 million. The movie's budget supposedly around $350 million. It made over, $1.5 billion at this point. It'll surely hit $2 billion at some point. You know, I would assume that the casting budget for that film is probably $150 to $200 million. I could be foolishly thinking that, but I think the special effects are damn near $100 million. So, you know, we're talking cast and crew, the director, everyone involved, right? But those actors, they cost a tremendous amount of money, but guess what? They show up for work, they blast out a great film, as long as the script's fantastic, which that script was very solid, you got a great film on your hands, and you have something that's worth 10 times as much as you spent, you know, almost seven, eight times more than you spent. Who knows, right? It's not over yet. So let me give you some very quick observations about what I think is going on now, and then let's reverse back to the genesis of how these kind of things happen, because I watched a bunch of it happen in Electronic Arts. When I worked for Electronic Arts, they were the number one publisher of video games in the world. We were the first people to hit $1 billion in 1 year of gross sales. We were the first to hit $3 billion. And then Activision, through financing World of Warcraft, you know, Blizzard had basically run out of money and said, we need more money. I think it was about $123 million to finish World of Warcraft. They had a beautiful franchise called Warcraft. It was ready to go. They had just an inspired team that just, I mean, they not only hit it out of like Fenway Park, but the ball is still traveling in the universe, you know, for the first version of this game. I mean, it will probably never be outdone until we have more technology that we can blow people away with, you know. But inside, you know, Electronic Arts, what we had was a great indie team of developers and designers. A lot of times, you know, the code is done off-site by some really hot company that is, you know, some major experts that know how to make things. Wasn't always that way. But what they did was a small, clicky group of folks that had a financial line item, like a bucket in the budget. They get this much money, and if they make this much money over some expected amount of revenue, they start getting profit sharing. And so it was hugely inspiring to the team to not only do what they love to do for a living, have the corporate heads out of their face, no marketing team telling them how to program a game, which happens. It's just insane, right? Right before Andretti Racing was created by EA, which I think was 96, they, you know, it's the first 3D racing game on a console. Tremendous, right? PS1, right? Marketing came to the high score group run by Michael Pohl, and they said, we've got the engine you're going to use to make this game. And we looked at it, and it was Pole Position from 1985, bar none. It was like a car with a pin stuck through it, and all you could see was the front end kind of turning, and then the track would kind of do this, just like Pole Position, the video game. And of course, everyone was like, what are you doing talking to us? You're marketing. Go figure out how to make an ad. go make some tchotchkes, you know. So that idea got thrown out. One of the best video games of the time was created. You know, fully accurate maps of real courses. We had advertising. We thought this was a good idea. Advertising in the game exactly like it's in the course. It was very realistic. It was amazing. A lot of hardships, too. I mean, first 3D game in the world. We were playing betas where the polygons of the track were ripping apart. So you could see underneath, you know, parts of the game. The physics came in perfectly real. And that doesn't work with hand controllers or keyboards because it's way too much data from a hand controller. And so you'd wreck your car in 2 seconds because unlike a Formula One steering wheel, which turns, you know, just a little bit, you could do a 360 on the steering wheel, no problem. And that's not what happens in the real world. So we're figuring all that stuff out. But that team was just blowing the doors off of titles. One after another after another. There's a bunch of games that did extremely well. They don't get any fanfare at all. And of course, EA bought a bunch of studios and got a bad rep because they buy a studio just before they're about to crash. Their team had been obliterated. Something went wrong at that company, but their last title was great. EA buys them. They release the piece of crap that they know they've got in the chute, and EA got blamed for it, which is why EA got a big bad reputation. Now, EA's done some other things, experimenting with their business models and pissed a lot of people off in this last decade, and that doesn't have anything to do with what I know about them. Right now, gaming is hurting badly. Activision Blizzard. They're in a really bad situation. Super bad situation. World of Warcraft is dead. The only one playing that game are folks that have just either recently discovered and having fun with all the previous expansion packs that they got right, or they're simply diehard fans that are probably, you know, tears running down their face constantly as they wish the game was good. They've lost their mojo. The people that made those expansions amazing and that knew when an expansion was finished and knew how to design one on paper before they ever started any production, those people don't exist anymore at that company. Or if they do, they're not being listened to, and that's the same problem you have, right? I can tell you right now, when I had my 40th birthday at a very good friend of mine's house, a bunch of Blizzard guys showed up. Because they like my friend, he's famous for some other stuff, and I got to meet a bunch of them, and then started hanging out with them, started becoming friends with them, and started learning about the internals of Blizzard. And at that time, Blizzard was still knocking it out of the park. Great expansions. And then that mystery project got lit up. Everybody went over to the mystery project. All of a sudden, you know, things started dying off internally. The expansions started to have a few problems. And then eventually the big project gets canceled. All those people leave leave Blizzard. And now Blizzard's just hollow of its original DNA. Now, of course, there's some folks that are still there. But you'll also find out a lot of folks lie about what they do on video games. I definitely met one of their longest employees. I met the CEO 4 or 5 times at various events in Huntington Beach. And usually at Oktoberfest, really funny, the guy that just left. Super nice guy. Super nice guy. But, you know, he doesn't get in everybody's way. But there's some people that will run around from Blizzard and they'll be like, I do this, I do that. And then you find out internally they do shit. In fact, they actually take other artists' artwork and put their name on it and release it as their own stuff. I mean, got some of those people in there too. It's bad news, man. It's exactly how you kill your company. And usually what happens is once they start getting called out, they start doubling down. No, we're not that way, when they really are. And so they get this implosion of complete denial about how the company works. And then everybody just wants to get a paycheck and go home until the whole place closes down. But StarCraft, what are you going to do? It's locked into so many esports at this point. To add one little troop or one little modification, you have, you know, a million people crying like ball babies because it messes up the balance of the game. It probably does. Can't invent a brand new race very easily because it's so locked into esports. You can't just play a game and have fun with it. It's got to pay off in this esports thing. So esports is one of the clamps on game design. Obviously, they have the same thing inside of World of Warcraft, where you can have these, I forgot what the hell they're called, the sparring matches where you're just basically team against team. For me, that shit's so damn boring. I want story. I want to crawl out of the world I'm in. I don't want some 12-year-old kid lipping off to me online. You know, give me a break. Go create a separate game with those assets. Get that code completely out of my game so that I don't have to bump into this whole thing, right? That's my personal opinion. Diablo 3. Fantastic game. What's Blizzard's problem? Just release an expansion pack that gives us more artwork, new locations, new storyline. You don't need to change anything. You could reuse some of the characters. I don't care. Just put me in a different place. Advance the storyline. Create a side storyline. A little, Rogue One off on the side. I'll give you money. I'll play it. And then when I go into the dungeon, you know, I got some more Chotskys. You get more dungeon art, basically, right? When it's all over. Nope. They sit there pretending like that's impossible. Wondering why the revenue's going down. Now they're trying to put Diablo on a telephone. Well, they're doing it, right? Bad ideas. Because someone walks in the room and goes, oh, you know, mobile's huge for a handful of people. When you, Blizzard did the mistake that Apple did. Steve Jobs always said, I make things that I love and that my employees love. And then you end up loving it too. And it's nothing you would expect. And it's absolutely nothing a marketing department can conceive of, because marketing people are not engineers. They're not inventors. They don't even know what's possible. So don't listen to them. Don't do focus groups to figure out what you make next, lest you fail and bankrupt your company. Well, Blizzard has done too much of that. That's why you got mobile Diablo. It's okay if you do that, but don't let go of the major product. Now they're talking about canceling Hearthstone and a bunch of other stuff. And they may never do those cancellations, but they're looking at canceling two or three of their other games. Because they're not making money, and it costs a lot of money to make these things and keep them alive, and the Battle.net fees and all that stuff. But that's just Blizzard. Breaks my heart. Great company. I've seen some of my closest friends who used to work there, you know, recently have to leave, and it just blows my mind because they have the DNA that company needs, you know. But the number one thing that's killing gaming right now is there's too many platforms. Think about it. Everyone's got mobile, and of course that's the big thing now. Mobile. Well, there's only so much you can have in terms of an experience on a mobile device. Even if you get a big powerful tablet, come on. It's a little tiny, 12-inch screen if you spend a ton of money. You know, $1,500, you can get yourself a beefed up, iPad. It still sucks compared to a 60-inch television. Some of you folks have 80-inch televisions. They're not that expensive anymore. Talk about a fully immersive experience. Think about an 80-inch television split in half so you could play co-op. You still have 40 inches a piece, according to Pythagoras' theorem and all that, but you have a giant piece of real estate to play with. Well, there still are, the PS4, Xbox 360, you got your Nintendo. But these platforms, initially, just so that you guys know, they were designed to sit on your entertainment center for 10 years before they were versioned. That was the goal. And then, of course, PCs, the personal computers at home, are light years beyond those consoles by the time that even the 7-year mark is showing up. Hell, even probably before the 5-year mark shows up. So now people look at their computers and they look at these consoles and they're like, this is a horrible experience, or it's not as good. Now, today, the consoles are pretty badass, but still, there's limitations to these things. People can feel it. Now, there's too many consoles. You got to make this religious choice. Well, the Sony's got that exclusive game, and the Xbox 360 has an exclusive game, and they're all like, $600 when they first come out. Am I going to wait 2, 3, 4, 5 years for the thing to get to $399 or $299? Nah, if you're a gamer, you want it right away. You don't want some half-assed thing. You don't want to spend $300 on a console and then, $4,000 or $5,000 on the games as you get them. And you're only like, 6 games in, and here comes the new console. And you start to feel like, oh my God, I just threw away all that money. Mobile had a huge problem when mobile games sucked, it had a huge problem before it got really cool with smartphones, and now we're back to the shitty problem. And it goes something like this. The carriers used to be where when you got a phone, you had a Sprint phone or, you know, AT&T phone or whatever, Verizon phone, T-Mobile, and you had to go to their store to buy a game. And you would have to pay them special amounts of money to promo your game in the top 10. And then the odds that anyone would see your game if you weren't in the top 10 were next to zero. If you were 11, you went down, you know, orders of magnitude from ever being seen. Well, here comes the iPhone. It's a little bit better. It's one vendor. It's Apple. They want to promote games as much as possible. And so their store was redesigned to get rid of this top 10 thing. I mean, they all have their top. But you can scroll for miles now and see a bunch of different games you wouldn't see. They have different ways of filtering it. These games have made a lot of money. These games have a lot of downloads, but it's free. You can drill down into categories now a lot better than they used to be. But now, it's back to that pretty much. There's about three ways to filter things. Nobody usually hits the filter and tries to go any deeper. They do a lot of cross promotion, which is really cool. I found a lot of great games nowadays by going to the one I like and then specifically revisiting the game I have already exhausted in the store just to see what the recommendations are based on other people who like this game also like this game. It's a very common algorithm that's out there today. But then there's the phone. Okay, there's a lot of experiences on the phone that I appreciate when I'm stuck on an airport, on a plane, when I'm at night and I'm in bed, I just want to unwind my mind. Sure, that's cool. But I desperately miss something big. Something like a Deus Ex coming out with some badass, you know, sequel. And there are great franchises out there, and I'm not saying any of the great franchises that you love are bad. They're great. And those are the franchises that are literally the tent poles holding up the circus at this point. But there used to be a lot more choices, folks. One of the saddest things that's happened pretty much to the entire world, and it's something that I hope gets reprised in a way, and that is that brick and mortar stores have been all but destroyed. And anybody who's still brick and mortar has to be a big Target, a Walmart, some big giant thing. But we all know that GameStops are all being shut down, downsizing, because everybody wants to get it online. You can watch the trailer to figure out if you like the gameplay, and you talk to some of your friends, and then boom, you just order it straight to your house. Okay. You know, I think I might have mentioned an episode that hasn't aired yet that our local electronic store is Fry's, which is now across the United States. Looks like they're going out of business. Fry's, you know, their problem is they didn't focus on what they were good at. They expanded into a bunch of different territories. Our local Fry's literally started selling, you know, vacuum cleaners and washers and dryers, and, you know, then I guess that's okay. They were always known for selling everything. When they opened up in the Bay Area, I lived there right when they opened up, and I remember going to the one in Mountain View, which I think is one of their very first stores they ever opened, and, you know, it was like tampons next to video games right at the register. It was really funny. And it was like everybody loved it because it was also small. So they didn't have a lot of overhead with the rent. They didn't carry everything on planet Earth. And they tended to, at the time, to hire super-duper expert nerd kids who knew everything about everything. Now, they still have some great staff members that, man, you go into the router section, and these dudes, you tell them what you're looking for and what you need, and they've got all the questions for you. It's fantastic. You know, other times, I've walked into the store once, went over to the camera section, and stood there. This was in the Bay Area. And I'm trying to get a camera real fast. I had two guys talking to each other right in front of me, badges on, whole thing. And so I'm sitting there, I'm being polite, trying to let them get their thing done. But now I'm listening to them, and they're talking about nothing, you know. And so I go, hey, can you guys help me with the camera section real fast? They literally looked at me. didn't acknowledge I existed other than to look at me, didn't say anything, went back and started looking at each other. Unbelievable, right? Now, those little things happen everywhere you go, and I'm not saying that's indicative of all the stores, but I remember that experience. So the one thing, the reason why I mentioned brick and mortar real quickly is because there's an experience that used to exist that was phenomenal. And I will tell you, it's a two-factor system that has killed this, and if we ever brought it back, it would be phenomenal. And it's actually killed a particular species of video game that we no longer make. And if you know of anything that's being made that's like this, please say it in the comments down below. But we used to buy games in boxes. Cardboard boxes. And then, of course, the video game companies learned they can press it on a disc, put it in a little plastic, you know, CD, DVD, Blu-ray container. You get this little teeny tiny manual in there, which is so tiny, and it's bullshit. You throw the thing away or whatever. You keep it for the collection or whatever, right? But when you got a box, here's what was cool about this. And some of you will remember experiences that are just fascinating. But you get this box. And, you know, like LucasArts that released Loom, that released the Indiana Jones series, the Carmen Sandiego series, the Sierra Online games with, Leisure Suit Larry, Space Quest, King's Quest, all those games. You'd open this box and you'd start pulling out, you know, like Indiana Jones books, like the one he had in the first, the third one where he was reading through it on how to find the Holy Grail, right? You would get books like that in the box. It was a very atmospheric, out-of-box experience where just the materials that you brought out of the box would set the scene for you. Some of them had posters that you put on your wall that had information on it. And, you know, Fallout, Bethesda has some special edition ones. And, you know, Blizzard has, like, the big collector's edition boxes. I've got them signed by all the creators. Those are okay. But, the, you know, a big hardback book is not what we're talking about. An extra CD of the sounds of the soundtrack, it's not what I'm talking about. A poster that doesn't do anything, it's not what I'm talking about. But when you got Fallout, you got a little Pip-Boy you could put on your arm. I mean, you know, you don't do it. Thing broke instantaneously. Bethesda has the worst reputation for releasing shit. It's crazy. They had a duffel bag in one of them, and everybody said the thing they got was plastic and junk, right? Yeah, charging $80 for a box for a piece of cardboard doesn't give you any leeway to create quality products, does it, Bethesda? Really funny. I love you guys, but damn, come on now. But this experience disappeared in the 90s when everything started going into these CD cases. Super sad, man. It kills the experience. We have a definition of the experience, and the definition is do what you can with the assets in the box to set the scene, to give someone, you know, like, imagine, like, back in the day before we had cell phones, at least that did anything other than make a phone call, you could take that little book to bed at night and have your little lamp pointing and you're reading about how your troops work and how everything works. It's all in the book. Now today, they're so freaking lazy. They're like, well, what if we change the paragraph? What if we update the video game and tune that character, this, that, and the other thing? Okay, well, don't put stats in the freaking manual. Just tell me, this tower does this, this guy does that, this sword does this on average, okay? Now, with World of Warcraft, there's limitations because there's, what, 50,000 items you can pick up in that game? Not talking about that, but still, think about it. Sit down the lore people at Blizzard and say, we're gonna rebirth this whole thing. We're going to have a poster. We're going to have a little book. We're going to actually buy some little items made, you know, like maybe a monocle or some little coin that's special to something, whatever. It's just something to set the scene. So that whole experience dried up. And the only experience you ever get now is this dry-ass experience through the screen. I'm still in my living room, still in my bed. Not that interesting. What you wanted to do was have some assets in the outside world that would give you the notion of how intense this game was going to be and how much you're going to be exploring the game. So it used to be, when I was leaving the big console game, PC game division to go into internet and then bounce out to my own company that I created, everyone was trying to make video games more movie-like because they realized this video power is here. They knew that we were going to be migrating to internal hard drives. The medium was going to eventually start getting downloaded. So really, the economy of a video game, meaning your disk space, your memory inside the unit, your sound power, your 3D animation power, all that stuff was starting to peel off. There weren't any limitations, you know. We still have limitations on memory inside these units, which is, in my opinion, unforgivable. I mean, we should be able to have games like World of Warcraft on a console. This bullshit of not being able to have a keyboard connected to it is stupid. You got a bunch of USB ports on all these units, but if you plug a keyboard in, nothing happens. I mean, really? You can't get a keyboard driver for a freaking console? No. Some of you may know that's different now. I don't know. I don't own any consoles anymore. I have a PS3 that's super sexy and collecting dust. It's the first version of it, which was all round and super polished out and glossy. But they were trying to make a bunch of story, and they were studying cinematography. EA ended up hiring some professional cinematographers and directors to teach them how to do this. You know, one of the last projects I was involved in, just as like a little, I mean, again, you're just a dude that knows some stuff and you pitch in some ideas, but someone found out my love for film, and it was the golf series we had at EA, and they were like, well, how would you move the camera to make this more cinematic? Because we know how it's filmed on television. We got all that in the game. Is there something else that we can do? So we're all pitching in our ideas. It used to be that we would worry about story not being that deep in a video game. As these games started to blow up, you know, it starts to cost a lot of money. People are like, well, we're going to have this city and we're going to have this place. And you're going to be able to go into all these doors and stuff. When everything was done by hand, that equaled a tremendous amount of money. Then coders got smart. And they're like, oh, we're going to procedurally generate a bunch of this stuff. Just like Diablo dungeons. They're all procedurally generated. You never see the same dungeon twice, right? Brilliant. Brought down the costs. And then they could randomly overlay on top of a particular room a storyline. They just have to make sure the items that the story is going to require to complete this particular quest are in that location. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Now, with games like World of Warcraft, you definitely have to have places that exist because quests don't change, and you're going to be able to tell your buddy, yeah, go up there, you know, you're on a headset, you know, you go upstairs, you see that thing? Okay, and it's right there under the book. Okay. Oh, yeah, you totally got it. Yeah, great, right? So what we don't have in terms of limitation, we don't have any limitation with creativity. You know, Destiny 2, right? Amazing visual effects on this title, amazing storylines. You can always make things better, but come on, they've got to get the game done and out the door at some point. I think Fallout 3 was fantastic, save the engine that they decided to use could not handle expansions on any platform without crashing. PC was the less crashy one. Fallout 4, I think, was utterly a 10. A 10 out of 10. I think Fallout 4 is tremendous. I've been playing that game for 3 years. I haven't played it for several months, but I still find rooms. I still find brand new places. It's crazy. I get that discovery thing across the top. Now, what I do think is a design flaw with games like that. Fallout 4 has three different endings. You are responsible for saving the game before you make the ultimate decision about which of the three endings you're going to go to. The game should rewind itself back to that decision point and let you automatically, through the design of the engine, go for option 2, option 3, and relive the world past that point, in my opinion. But that's not what's wrong with the gaming industry. The other gigantic problem with the gaming industry, and this is going to sound anti-free market, okay? And let me just explain it. A bunch of shit games are made 24/7. A bunch of shitty games. Games with amazing art packages, amazing sound packages. I mean, they look phenomenal. A bunch of them are just copycat games out of China and Russia. They just take a game and they copy themselves. Not necessarily you, but they copy themselves like 25 times. The other huge thing that's going on is that they give you false trailers of gameplay. How many times have you seen these big cinematic, amazing things, and you download it? You even see it on TV. Someone will promote the game in front of one of these channels on YouTube, and they'll literally show you a video of gameplay that does not exist in the game. There's a bunch of these Manage Your City games where they say, oh, there's a bunch of zombie sieges on you, and you have to do all this stuff. And they make it look like it's like World of War, or not World of Warcraft, like a Command and Conquer type game. And you get in there, and you can't put the tower wherever you want. It's got these little sockets that you have to put them in, you know. It's just stupid. So here's what I think could help the game industry tremendously. Somebody has to come up with a brand, and you're essentially like a consumer protection group for gamers. And you get in there and you look at the game and you give it a classification. It is one of these type of games. Pick out the genre. It is like these other games. Now, is it original or is it a copy? If it's a copy, you need to put it in the copy column as well. It's another ripoff of this game. It's exactly like that game, but they've done this and this and this. Maybe it's better in a certain way. Maybe it's crappier in a certain way. Yes, there are puzzle game categories, there's hidden objects, you know, for casual gaming. There are a lot of great keywords in there. But the problem is that they're setting the expectation, especially with a bunch of these false reviews too. And the other big rub is that these companies in China, I've seen videos, you've probably seen videos of this, where they have literally tens of thousands of cell phones on what looks like a magazine rack. And they're all plugged in, and they are simply just waking up, going into a, you know, a review forum, logging in, and putting in some just cut and paste article or, you know, review on something, making the game look like it's been five starred by 20,000 people. You get into it and you play for 2 seconds, and you're like, oh my God. And the second you go back into the reviews and hit the one star index on the reviews, you start finding out that nobody likes this game and it has a bunch of problems and da 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 da. But you might have paid for it before that's over. It used to be, and I think this is still the case with the consoles, you can't just put a game on the Sony PlayStation. You can't just put a game on the Xbox. You can't. They have to look at your game and approve of it. It's got to be up to the par of this console, because they're going to take the reputation hit if it's a piece of junk. That's brilliant. I would say that you need to turn that standard up as high as you can get it and make sure people understand. Maybe there's an indie game channel where a lot of lesser products can be reviewed. I mean, you know, why not make it a three-tier system at minimum? Super high-level games that the company that makes the console says, this is what we're willing to sponsor, an indie area, which is the higher-end indie area. And then maybe the complete sandbox area where you can just play around with shit constantly, right? It's free. That way you don't have to worry about refunding and have all that nightmare. Now, one of the coolest things that's happened, but it's still struggling, is Steam. Steam is a cool platform. You get on there and you have a lot of the classic games for nothing. I mean, like pennies on the dollar. I went up the other day, and they were blowing out games that I have absolutely drooled over. They're not as fun to play, you know, later on in life, but you get it for $3. I was looking at the Space Quest series. What, like, they made way more than I ever thought. I think they're up to 6 or 7 Space Quests or something like that before they turned off the company, Sierra Online. I think I could buy the whole thing for $4. You know, I tried to play it one day, about 10, 15 years ago, and it was so slow, I couldn't stomach it. But there's a lot of classic games, if they just resurrect it and get it executable, I'd pay money for it, you know? The only thing that Steam runs into is that a lot of companies won't sell their games through Steam, because they don't want to give Steam any money. So, you know, they can't even do, like, what's really sad is, like, a World of Warcraft installer. Okay, so you're not going to give, you know, Blizzard's not going to give you the normal commission that you would, you know, get off a normal video game, but just do some special business deal where you say, look, do you ever buy advertising, Blizzard? Yep. How much do you pay if someone clicks the ad and actually installs the video game and starts a subscription with you? Oh, well, we'll give them like $5. All right, well, why don't you give us $5 if we're able to hook that little link up? Whatever you pay for advertising, pay for us. We're going to use it as an anchor to get people to come to us for this other thing. What was it? Fallout 76. I think refused. I don't know if it's there yet, but they refused to go through Steam. They're like, we're the bomb. And then 76 tanks hardcore. Okay. I don't think there's a problem with the amount of video game companies. I think that's always fun, always healthy. I think that when the video games were coming out, you know, the very first video games we really had were the stand-up coin-op games, right? And then it was push the barrier. And then you got the Nintendo. And then, we always had that Atari 2600, which was sort of kind of lame rip-offs of the coin-op games. But still, you got to do it in your house for free. You got to play it as much as you want. You had the Intellivision, ColecoVision, Nintendo, Super Nintendo. And so that was fun. I mean, those Nintendo probably hit it out of the park more than any other home console in world history, because people still play Zelda. My smoke lounge has the SNES, reboot box. We must have played Zelda, 50 times. Finished the game just on a Saturday afternoon because we're bored. Just finished the game. This is this year. So the other thing, if we go off back to story and the game design itself, we have great game engines now. There's no problem with sickness. There's no problem with being able to create a game properly, so you don't have to fight the engine anymore like you used to back in the 90s when we were trying to push everything into 3D. We have enough memory and disk space and computer processing speed and I/O speed on the machines that we can do infinite scrolling worlds. Hey, that's cool. That means there's a pretty much what you can imagine can be made inside the game. That's great. But now, let's look at Nintendo for a split second. When you were in the coin-op world, before Nintendo really got into the home console thing, the algorithms were so tight for what was a video game. What was a game in general? Asteroids and what is it? Gorf, I think was one of the games. But you had Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man, your Star Castle. I mean, just a billion games, right? But they were all very limited in what they did. So what that allowed the game designers to do is to figure out what's fun about this. It's very repetitive. So whatever we're repeating has got to be very addictive to the mind. It's got to be a dopamine drop at a certain interval, right? You can't stay in the, like in Pac-Man. You don't have the ability to eat the ghost the entire time. They put those bigger pellets in all four corners, so it's difficult to get to. It's by design, it creates a distance in time that you're going to be able to turn them into ghosts. And you have a lot of other little dots you got to eat up before the game level's over. Plus, they give you little tchotchkes, little cherries, little slices of watermelon or whatever, which will make you go after that thing, baiting you away from these other four corners that will allow you to be invincible. Those smaller game designs allowed their brains to hone the design. Today, it is very, very tough because we are now emulating reality most of the time in these video games, right? The war games are phenomenal. The science fiction games are phenomenal. Now you are simulating reality. And reality is already so complex that, it's tough. Plus, when you tell the gamers this is going to be photoreal, oh my God, the amount of money you just spent with those few words, it's going to be photoreal, right? You quadrupled your budget automatically, and you're going to let the public down most likely because you're not going to be able to actually achieve it. Now, they're getting close, right? They're getting super duper close with these games. And so it starts to become a bit like a movie, like my movie episode where I said, look, what is entertainment? It's being redefined. It's no longer a good story. You're going for a bunch of special effects, maybe some sound effects and a soundtrack. That's it. You don't even remember what the movie's about. Well, games are kind of slipping into that because the stories are, in some cases, very dry or very repetitive. Nintendo, I promised I was going to bring them back into conversation. Here's how they roll, at least how they used to roll. I think they still do it. In Japan, as I understand it, the game designers of Nintendo. One, as I've been told, they wear lab coats, and they conduct numerous psychological experiments on those little tiny game elements to see what makes your brain feel good and how fast they can make you feel good before you start to lose your addiction to that thing because you're running out of chemicals in your body. This is something I teach in college. You have a certain amount of dopamine you can create, and you could drain it every second, but then, you know, the little packet of dopamine is less, and so the amount of stimulation you can get is less, and it becomes a diminishing return before your brain starts canceling it out. Headshot, if everything you did was a headshot every 3 or 4 seconds in a video game, you would stop playing forever very quickly, that particular video game. It has to be a rare thing before you're going to feel the reward of it. Why does Zelda hold up? Why does Zelda 1, 2, maybe 3 hold up perfectly? 1 and 2 is just magical. Absolutely magical. Well, it's a big giant world. You can't do everything. You can't get these giant pops all the time because you've got to do things. World of Warcraft had that perfectly. You get a bunch of quests. Oh, go grind a bunch of zebras over there, grind a bunch of these things over here, do a FedEx delivery thing here. I'm going to give you this. Go give it to that guy over there. He's going to give you something else, and you're going to take it over there. And eventually, you'll learn how to fly. You know what I mean? Something like that. It's a beautiful chain of command that will help structure something reliable within the video game to give you the rewards that you want. What I think is really funny, there's a game out there called Rust. I've never played it, but I have watched I don't know how many hours of the Rust raids, of just Rust gameplay, and it fascinates me that this game is being played by... I love watching it. It's fun. It's fun to watch. But if you haven't played this game, it's not that expensive. You start off naked. I mean, I think you're completely naked. And you run around, and I think the first weapon you can have is you got to find a rock on the ground, pick it up, and you got to go hit someone on the head with it before you're going to get any points for anything. The only way you can acquire anything without doing the rock routine is to find someone else's stash, find a dead body, find an open house, which would probably never happen, lest someone make a huge mistake. But these kids grind forever to get anything of any substance, pretty much like it would be in the real world if we went into some apocalyptic state. Yeah, so if you see someone in Rust wearing a really cool gear and having an AK-47 with a paint job on it and having a missile launcher, having any rounds for the missile launcher, these people have teamed up and been brutalized. The amount of suffering they've gone through to play this game is fascinating to me. What that tells me is that, think about it, anyone who plays Rust, well, they're obviously extremely good at video games, period. If they're good at Rust, they're really good at everything else, let me tell you. But they have every other video game in the world to choose from. So why aren't they playing those other games? They have huge cinematic stories. You know, what was it, Metal Gear Solid 3, I think had over 20 hours of cutscenes. They could be playing that. Or the next one of it, and the next one, and the next one. No, they're playing Rust. Because they sort of just like, I don't want all that. I just want to have something that's challenging, that's really challenging. I don't even know if there's a game of that magnitude that they put a tremendous amount of R&D in this game. I mean, hats off to the entire development team and the mods that people have created. But these games are more appealing. It's fascinating, right? Now, speaking of mods, mods have become a gigantic thing. And let me just share with you the first mod I ever heard of. I'm sure there's others, but this is the first mod I ever heard of, and it is one of the most epic mods ever made in history, and it's called Duke Nukem. Somebody took the Doom engine, came up with this amazing fictional character, Duke Nukem, put him in a world where he was fighting these hogs. You know, hey, I mean, it was it, damn, those aliens smashed up my ride. Mm-hmm. And so you had this ludicrous world. You could go into a strip joint and tip a stripper by the time the third version came out, I think it was the third or the second, whatever that was, you could take a piss in a urinal. You'd see your piss stream hitting the urinal. Hilarious. You'd go up to the mirror and push the space bar and you'd be like, something like, who's that sexy guy? Or something like that, right? Also had one of the most hilarious voice tracks of any game on planet Earth. The most lewd and crude stuff a dude could say. You kill a guy and, you know, your ass, your face, what's the difference, right? Just unbelievable. I'm going to rip off your head and shit down your neck. Balls of Steel. Go see Balls of Steel, that old video on YouTube. Just look up Balls of Steel. Some guy tortured this woman with a Duke Nukem soundboard. And nobody knew who Duke Nukem was. You know, it was nuts. No one even mentioned the guy's name the whole time that he's terrorizing this woman with this thing. He breaks her in the end. But boy, this woman's got a mouth on her. Holy cow. But mods are huge. Some people rather play mods than any of the games that originally release. There are companies that make nothing but mods, and they make a tremendous amount of money off the mods. I don't know how you compete with the kids out there that have a lot of time on their hands. One of the funniest things that would happen at Electronic Arts would be we would go off, we'd be playing something, a Duke Nukem or, you know, Command & Conquer type game, and then we would go to lunch, and, you know, we're all high on our food, and all these kids that work for EA that don't realize that they really don't know anything about engineering, they don't really know anything about game design, some of them. Some people, I'll tell you, there's two types of game designers in the world, just so you know. They're your brilliant conceptualists. Someone that says, I got a blank piece of paper, and I'm going to create an amazing world, an amazing set of characters, the conflict. It's going to have an endless, like a bottomless pit of story that can occur if it's some type of MMO. Those are your super geniuses. Those are the people that pay the bills. But then you'll have this other phenomenon that happens that even though that conceptualizing person, and there's a few that could do it soup to nuts, I mean, start to finish. Was it I forgot the gentleman's name, makes Metal Gear Solid, but he's one of those uber geniuses. Then you have folks that can't conceive of anything worth playing, and I mean at all. But they are amazing polishers, tuners. They get in and they realize what you were trying to do. They immediately understand what the hell you were trying to do. And they're like, well, that's great, but okay, let me do the battle tables. You know, let me figure out how we work out swords and armor and your stats and your body. And they make the game come to life. You need both forces in your company if it's going to be successful. Ego can kill a lot of companies. I will say that Electronic Arts, it was fantastic at not acquiring egos. I was very, very happy working there. And again, if some folks had rumors of being egotistical, I'll just tell you one that was a rumor. It wasn't the case. But when American McGee joined us, and he was he made his mark on Quake. He did at least Quake 2 and Quake 3. He's an amazing level designer, phenomenal. But he's also a great franchise inventor as well. But he came to our company to do Alice. And his original vision for Alice was amazing. The game engines weren't quite up to his visionary capabilities, so he took it on the chin with the first Alice release, but it was no problem for him. But that guy, internally a little bit, definitely externally, got this reputation for being a cocky guy, having a big ego, and I've sat down with this guy several times. And this is an important life lesson, just so that you know. He's one of the most humble guys on planet Earth. He's soft-spoken. He's confident in what he does, but he's not a jerk about it. He never did anything in front of me that ever would indicate that he had anything other than confidence in what he did. And even that was pretty soft-spoken. I mean, we would hurl more compliments at the guy than he would ever claim about his past. It was interesting. And he had earned it. He had earned it. But we spent millions on the PR for Alice. And so this guy is being literally forced to be in front of cameras and forced to pose for things and forced to use his name on everything. in the end, that rubbed off on him. He didn't rub off on it, right? So he got this weird reputation for having this big ego. He's not like that at all. He's a great guy. And he surrounds himself with equally humble, brilliant people constantly. I think he's been in China now for quite some time. But, you know, so that if you do get someone with an ego, and the only ego guy I ever met was like a coder for the web, and he was useless. He was in and out so fast, it wasn't even funny. Now, ego can be mistaken for something else, which is people who are eccentric. It's a company that it's in England that made Black and White. It's Lion something. I can't remember their name right now offhand. But you have eccentric people that are like, they're not big socialites, right? They like to be in their world. Plus, they've got a huge list of things that they want to do to make the next video game. And so they don't go out and hobnob with everybody. When you have a genius like that or a group of them like this, as a video game company, you do the Marvel thing. You spend whatever money it's going to take to get them to the finish line. And if they need more money and they're going to delay, it'll be worth every penny because they're going to bring in the revenue. They're going to invent a franchise. And again, what you really want in terms of a video game to be successful is a game that everyone who plays that type of game has to own the game. They can't just play it at a friend's and go home. They're going to play it at their friend's, drive straight to a place like a GameStop so they don't have to wait for the mail, and they take it home. That's a great video game. So how do we fix this? That's tough. It's a systemic problem of multiple dimensions, right? What can't we fix? Well, we probably can't fix the fact that there are probably too many platforms out there. We have the PCs. We have all the mobile tablet devices. We've got, at least 3 super-duper consoles. VR is trying to be a layer on top of that. But VR requires so much horsepower that whatever you get out of a console is kind of, it's okay. When I taught with my buddy Richard Taylor, the first accredited VR class at Chapman University, a big film school, they had one computer when we got there that was capable of running a VR headset. My students at Noman have all been given free headsets, and they all gave them away because they don't have a system at home anymore to play because Tim Cook keeps saying, it's a post-PC era, get rid of your PCs. Then they had to release the iMac Pro so you could use a headset on it, and they priced it at the base model of $5,000. Give me a break. Any of you know how to build a PC? You know you could build a very nice VR headset PC for way under $5,000. And it's going to be built your way, right? VR isn't the solution. All the old farts that are like 55 and older, they're telling you AR, augmented reality is going to be everything. Seriously, run it forward. Run it forward as an inventor of technology. You can have all the money you want in the world. Where are you going to use VR? Maybe in my car. Safely, maybe projected up on my windshield so that I can, my Google Maps is literally telling me to, turn right here, turn left there, but it's also got to not get in the way of a little kid walking in front of my car. It can't give me the indication I can go when I'm actually at a stoplight. So the amount of refinement of AR is, 20 years out. If they haul ass, maybe 10 years out. It's not a solution for what we're talking about. We are going to remain staring at screens, letting that screen psychologically adopt our visual cortex to the point we don't see anything around the screen. That happens when you play a video game. Even your little tiny telephone. Your mind will adopt the phone screen as your full-blown vision. It's interesting. It's a phenomenon. Your brain has to pick reality. It does, and it picks the screen when it can. Plus, the screens are flickering at 60 frames a second, which is hypnotic for the mind. The other one would be to probably deflate the number of games in a particular studio. Now, there's a lot of studios that make one game, and all they do is they give it to the distributor, and it goes out the door. So you'll see Activision and then the other game title. But if you go to that studio, all they make is that game. And that's why those games are typically the most powerful games you can have in the industry. Now, EA, believe it or not, is sort of like that. You know, I think Tiburon, Florida still makes Madden. I think EA Canada still makes a ton of all the other games. But they have studios everywhere. Sometimes franchises just run their course. So what they need to do, potentially, is like the BBC. The BBC has an interesting thing that they do with their television shows on, what is it, Channel 4? I think that's the channel. They will make a very famous series on TV. Everybody loves it. But when they get to the next season and they go, okay, well, show us what you have. Show us what the storyline is. And they're like, eh, we're kind of thinking about this, thinking about that. BBC goes, well, we're going to mothball it until you really have something substantial. We're here for you as soon as you want to make that. But you don't seem like you have your ducks in a row. Godspeed to you. Same thing with video games. Some games, Nintendo has been pretty fantastic at holding back their titles until they've got something super special to show you. Zelda, for instance, held back until they're going to reinvent it in some 3D way, and then it's got to have the same super adventurous feel to it. Remember Squaresoft, which is now Square Enix, created the Final Fantasy series. Well, if you were into those series, you'll know that some of them are fantastic, some of them are crap. They'd be fantastic, then they'd be crap, then be fantastic again. Sometimes the fantastic part would only be the story and the cutscenes, and the gameplay is so boring that you're like, eh, this is old. I can tell you that Electronic Arts mothballed a lot of titles in the 90s that are ready to be rebooted. They had, was it the Jane series, right? Isn't Jane's is the military journal that comes out that documents all of the, and I apologize if they've done this and I'm just unaware of it, but it used to be the Jane series, and it was a bunch of war games. Then they had some war games that were kind of spoofy and they kind of fun, and I forgot the name of this one that we only sold 750,000 copies, so we didn't hit platinum, and so EA said, well, that just cost us too much money. One of them only sold 350,000 copies. And let me tell you, if you and I got together and made a video game and it sold 350,000 copies at $39 a piece back in the day, we not only would be living well, but we would definitely have enough money to make the sequel. Unfortunately, when an executive who doesn't play video games starts running a video game company, which unfortunately is the case for almost, well, every video game company that's failing right now, go to their top executives and go, how many video games do you play? Oh, well, maybe that's the problem. You couldn't tell a turd from a bar of gold if your life depended on it, if your kid's life's dependent on it. You're going to fail that test. So what do they get told? The word epic starts destroying their life. It's going to be epic. It's going to be, or badass. That's another one. It's going to be badass. It's going to be badass. It's going to be epic. Badass, epic, epic, badass. It's not. It's not at all epic or badass. You know what it is? It's trivial. It's cliche. And it's tired. It's usually what epic translates to. Epic would be someone who hasn't made a game in maybe 10 years, who's been thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it, and they're like, I've been watching all this cliche circle each other and eat each other alive. I've seen these game companies go down the tubes that used to be on top. And I'm thinking. And then, boom, this new thing comes out that just blows everything away. Take like World of Warcraft. You know, I did a whole episode on why I think it was tanking recently, right? I'm a huge fan of the franchise. Trust me. Played the game for 13 years straight, nonstop. I've got 9 top-level characters, not including the last expansion, which I couldn't possibly play. I actually resubscribed to try and play it again. It was like just boring me to death. Every friend I know bailed out of the game. It's horrible. But what have they been doing with World of Warcraft, right? They've been telling the same boring fucking lore forever and ever and ever, and then promised you they're going to make 7 more of the same lore today. They'll just tell you, oh yeah, we got all planned out. We got the next 10 years of World of Warcraft planned out. It's like, really? If you can even do that, you probably just spelled failure for your franchise. But what is World of Warcraft been for a really long time? Well, 2 things. It's been a comedy, which may be the essence you don't want to mess with, but I don't know. But it's also looked like a game made out of 2004. It's got an antiquated engine, antiquated battle scenes, because everything's top-down, third-person, right? It just feels like you're playing dad's chessboard from 1965, right? Or grandpa's board, right? They tried to make a movie of it. Meh. They tried to make the expansion, feed the movie. Meh. What haven't they done? Let's reset the whole clock. Let's say World of Warcraft gets canceled. It's there, but, you know, whatever. They're not going to update it for 10 years. They're not going to release a new one. And they're going to hunker down and create a brand new engine. And this engine is going to be as amazingly realistic as it can possibly be. You're in Orgrimmar in the first shot of this new game. You're not in a cutscene, but goddammit, you think you're in a cutscene because it looks so good. It's not a very good day, weather-wise. There's clouds, there's a little bit of rain. Hell, maybe there's even a lot of rain. You walk up on your first quest giver. This dude is not exactly happy to see you. He looks like he's been in 1,000 wars. You walk up on him and you can see the subdermal tissue in his face. And he looks at you just like Thanos in Endgame, right? And he just looks up at you and he's just like, what do you want? You know, one of those faces. And the rain's just sprinkling down his face. Yeah, his armor would shine if it was clean, but it's not. The city is full of life. It's got all kinds of wagons going by and chickens flapping in here and there. Someone's cutting the head off something to bake it for you, some rat head or something, because that's what they sell over there. You take it to a level of dimension, which would be the next fantasy that's not being satisfied in the engine. How many of you playing World of Warcraft? You could really apply this to any game that you want. But it looks like a video game. It looks ancient. And you're thinking, geez, how fun would it be to teleport into that world and actually be there? Be there in all of its grit and grime. You step onto the floorboards of the auction house and you hear the muddy, you know, grain underneath your feet crushing because you happen to step in a puddle that the other guy didn't. The goblin that's in there selling it to you, well, he's relatively dry and clean, so he's got a whole different thing. Maybe there's a VR element to it in 10 years. It's worth putting a headset on. If you have a VR situation, then you're going to shoot the game, like a movie where there's a few like little like 3D effect tchotskis that might make you jump a little bit. Some ceiling assembly that's going to come swinging by your head every once in a while because that's what it does. And you're like, oh my God, what's that, you know? You get on your mount, and your mount feels like an animal. It has all those little sounds that animals have, and its feet crunch on the ground in a particular way, and it steps in a puddle, and it goes splat instead of smush. You stop your animal in the middle of a sungrass field, right? And you can just stop and listen, and the sungrass just bangs into itself and makes that beautiful harmony in your brain. Now start telling stories. You start going into that dungeon. It's a whole lot scarier. The potential in your mind for what could be in that dungeon is firing off like crazy. But the game designers actually are going to blow you away with what you thought you were going to see and what you end up seeing. Pulling back on some of these franchises. Mothballing them for a little while, or maybe forever. Reinventing them. Yeah, spending a tremendous amount of money. But then what you do, for the franchises that are the staple diet of what you're doing, maybe the first thing you do is cancel all the crap. Just put it on mothballs. It's not going to cancel, but you know, it's like Blizzard. They held back for 10 years, 15 years on games, and blew our minds when the sequels came out. Hey, that was a great formula, wasn't it? You get your staple games dialed in, tightened up, updated. Listen to your players, if anything. They're not marketing firms. Listen to the players. Listen to your own heart. Start taking it way beyond what you think you can do so that even if you don't meet that goal, what you ended up achieving was the epic thing that you thought you were talking about when you created another boring sequel of the game. The other thing that kills a video game company are shareholders. Once your company gets so big that you go public and you've got a stock share, you're no longer making games anymore. You're trying to make money. And you will whore yourself out to anything that seems like it's an easy sell. Apple Computer, and they're trading over $200 right now. So good for them. But they have pulled out every single trick in the book to make money and not making new products, right? They got the new Mac Pro that's supposed to come out. That thing's going to cost so much, no one's going to buy it. I'm really sorry. It's just not going to happen. Do I want one? Hell yeah, I want one. Will I ever spend that kind of money on one? Not unless, you know, rain turns into money. It's not even smart if you have the money, because you can get a better machine on a PC. You can get laptops that are going to smoke that Mac Pro. It's just true. They're loud, they're big, they're thick, and they cost about $4,000, but it's going to be $6,000 less than that Mac Pro. And Apple thinks the computer should only last 2 years. That's what a Mac genius told me at their store. Well, hell, that's their philosophy. Are you willing to pay $5,000 a year for a computer before it starts to die? It may be 3 years if your Apple coverage is still effective. Now, for the game companies that are getting it right, you know, I think I would hope that they would heed all of these concerns and really, really pay attention to the companies that have gone under who were on top. Because the one, I think, genetic flaw of video game companies is that they perceive the age of those creating the games as a detriment to the company. The one thing Electronic Arts did well was hire senior producers, guys in their 40s, 50s, and now they have some folks in their 60s still cranking out the best titles in these companies. Because they've seen it all. They can smell crap. They know what a great game feels like. They know how to see the fundamentals of a game's design. It's interesting. With a bunch of kids, here's your problem. What can you do with a little kid? You can steal their nose, can't you? You can disconnect your thumb off of your hand, right? And they're just completely blown away. You can grab all those little card tricks that don't work with adults and play them on kids, and they completely believe it. Well, that's exactly what happens with kids who get into these video game companies, because they're not always the best players in the world. If the best players in the world could work for video game companies, maybe they have a design instinct, maybe. At best, they're like great testers to say that was total crap or that was fantastic. Why was it fantastic? Why was it better than the last version of the game? And listen to what they say and see if there's anything, a real distinction there. Because it might be they're such a fanboy, you can't get a decent opinion out of anyone. Apple surrounds itself and infects its company with fanboys as employees. And the problem with that is Tim Cook could take a crap on a piece of paper and push it out on a table and go, "What do you guys think? It's my new thing." And they're going to be, "Oh, Tim, it's so great. It's so great. You know, I love all your political and personal agendas too, by the way. Can I come to your house and eat cookies and milk?" A good seasoned game designer gets better with age, right? They do. They simply do. I know it's like maybe I'm promoting my own age bracket, but it's the truth. We've seen it all. We know color palettes that have become cliche. We know verbal phrases that are cliche. You know, if somehow you could turn off all video games for 20 years and then turn them all back on, yeah, sure, you could bring out all those old tricks and play them over again, but that's not what's going on. Everyone's getting completely exhausted of everything that's out there. Same thing with television and movies, same thing. So people are going to have to get back to fundamentals. Quality over quantity. But it's hard to tell a company with shareholders that you're not going to release 130 games this year. A lot of game companies, in order to fill those orders of those slots in their release pool, they go out and license a game or buy the company. And it's still crap. The other thing that companies don't have is usually, especially like a big giant company, they usually don't have one person overseeing what it is to be that company. To say, this is an EA game, this is not an EA game. This is an Activision game, this is not an Activision game. We don't distribute this crap. Now, obviously, someone is saying something like that. But to make it an absolute objective to say, like the old film studios, right? Again, Universal movies were Universal movies. 20th Century Fox, MGM, all these companies knew that there were movies that they were relied on to make. And so that's what they were really good at. They cracked those formulas. When a company is so diverse with so many different games, they just have to trust people. Okay, well, what's that like? Trusting people? Is your game going to be good? Oh, yes, sir, it's going to be so good. Okay, I'll see you next week. See you next month. See you next quarter, whatever. Hope it does well. And then the game goes out and tanks, and then they go back and have the conversation, some post-mortem, and it's like, well, you know, we thought that that was, you know what happened was that other company came up with that game first, and so they kind of blew our wad before, and da-da-da-da-da. Those things really happen. But sometimes it's a bunch of BS. When companies get real big and go public, they have to release titles on a particular interval to keep the stocks up, to keep the shareholders happy. And that's when you get crap. I know you feel me on this. Let me know what you think in the comments if you play video games. I'm sure a ton of you have played. Here's a couple ways to think about your comment. One, if you're an old coin-op person and you hate video games and computers, let me know that reason. If you used to play video games and you no longer play them anymore on any platform to speak of, let me know why you think you quit. What was the fundamental reason? And if your reason was, I just got busy, well, we all have that answer. It's probably not worth sharing. But if there's some specific thing about the games, their integrity, their fun, that's what I'd like to hear. And if you think there was a game that was fantastic, that they never sequeled, they sequeled badly, let me know that title, because I think that would be interesting data. I'm not involved with any video game companies right now. I just think it would be interesting to sort of delve into other people's ideas. Me? I don't play any console games anymore. Used to play the PS3 like crazy. Never got the Xbox because when I had the PS3, the Xbox had the glowing, crash problem. So I never got into that. Heard the 360 is fantastic. I definitely watch a lot of game reviews. I listen to a bunch of people's reviews. I think there's a reason why these game companies are going out. I mean, not the game companies, but the retailers are going out of business. I think it does go against the notion of just straight internet beating brick and mortar. I think it's because the industry itself is sagging. When I go onto a mobile store, it's the most depressing experience ever because these games suck, 99.9% of the time. And I really want them to succeed. Apple will take a game and say, this is one of the best games ever. And you jump into it and you're like, oh, it's an artsy fartsy game, which is why you thought it was great. It looks really different, but the gameplay is atrocious, especially on these laptops or these not laptops. Sorry, that'd probably be okay. But on the tablets and the phones, the interfaces are just shit. You know, there's that great game called Robot Warriors out there. The team making this game has done a great job. And of course, it's a microtransaction game, right? Microtransactions, I think, have killed gaming as well, right? People are supposed to spend $10,000 on a game that they downloaded for free. It's insane. It happens every day. People throw in, $1,000 of their hard-earned money, and they get way ahead of everyone else, and then it's just boring. For them, it's boring because they're either winning all the time or they're bumping against another guy who put $2,000 in, and you know you're losing, not because of your skill, but because someone spent a ton of money. This was made very famous in Asia. So microtransactions, probably should have mentioned that. I think that is something that only happens on mobile. It's only tolerated on mobile. You know, it's nice to have a little expansion back. That's why Steam, I think, is fantastic. Fallout 4, the whole Fallout franchise, like so many other games. You finish their core story. You buy these expansion packs. Boom, it's fantastic. A whole other wing on the house gets built and a whole other world you can teleport to. It's fantastic. Some of them are gifts to keep on giving, and some of them you just burn them up and it's over. Why Bethesda doesn't continue to make expansion packs with a special team, like mods? Hell, even pay some of the normal folks out there playing the game. When you play the game, you could download all the mods in the game. Why not just purchase one of those? Sell it through the Bethesda software franchise, and it's a trusted mod, you know? Anyway, I want to know as much as you can share about your opinion of this, because it's just a fascinating thing. It's an amazing industry. It promotes a lot of innovation, You know, without the video game industry, military simulations would suck. Okay. It has literally come out of that. And if it weren't for the video game industry, your computer would never get any faster. You don't need a faster computer to browse the internet, write a letter, maybe to video edit or do some special effects or something like that. But that's how the other side of it is. The film effects industry pushes the processor teams to get faster and faster and faster. What if Intel just said, this is it, this is as fast as we can go? Well, their sales would go down, right? But if your toothpaste said, that's as good as we can make it, maybe you'd still buy it. It's interesting, right? So anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. There's two feeds for video. Let me just put it this way. The feeds for video there, audio, social media. We have a locked Facebook group. Highly recommend you get in there. We have two ways to donate to the page, a remastered season one. Just go to the website. There's a search field, category list. Have some fun with it. I'll continue making improvements to that as the year progresses, but right now I'm stuck inside the season five intro. Today's date is August 6th. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. I just had to push this out there. I felt it. Anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.